KDBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. After Lahaina residents returned to their burned-out homes on Maui, Hawaii Public School Superintendent Keith Hayashi announced another milestone.
We are announcing that we will reopen our Lahaina schools and bring students back starting October 16th.
He says campus air and water testing have come back as safe. House and Senate working on separate deals to keep the government funding passed this weekend. New York judge finds former President Trump and his company deceived banks and insurers by overvaluing properties for years. Judgment is part of the New York Attorney General's civil lawsuit. Writers Guild of American Leadership signing off on a tentative deal with studios. It now goes to membership for a vote. Baltimore police searching for a rape and murder suspect. Mayor Brandon Scott says 32-year-old Jason Dean Billingsley is wanted for the murder of 26-year-old tech CEO Pavel LaPierre.
This person is extremely dangerous. We will not rest until justice is served.
This is ABC News. Singer Shakira has been charged with tax evasion in Spain for the second time. Canada's House of Commons Speaker has resigned for inviting a man who fought for a Nazi military unit during World War II to attend a speech by the Ukrainian president. Mother Nature may be squashing people's pumpkin plans this weekend. Farmers, including Kentucky's Nathan Hike, say they've weathered droughts and heavy rain, making for tough growing conditions.
We went out probably a month ago. It's just the blooms weren't opening and we couldn't hardly find any pumpkins.
But in Illinois, the largest pumpkin-producing state, the Farm Bureau reports a good growing season. Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences and the Museum of Motion Pictures are gifting Howard University a replacement Best Supporting Actress Oscar, won by Hattie McDaniel. She made history in 1940 as the first black person to be nominated for and then win an Academy Award for her supporting role in Gone with the Wind. Andy Field, ABC News.
Talk of Green Bay News, I'm Pete Schwabe. Here's what Green Bay needs to know.
The Green Bay Police Department is asking for your help in their search for a missing person. 41-year-old Christopher J. Bellinger has not been seen since September 6th. Authorities say he disappeared shortly after he was involved in an incident that left him with non-life-threatening injuries to his nose. His family says they have not heard from him since. Christopher was last seen driving a Toyota Sienna minivan, Wisconsin license plate AUA2937. He's 5'11 and about 210 pounds with brown eyes and brown hair. Authorities are asking anyone who has helpful information to contact the Green Bay Police Department. AAA says gas prices in Green Bay and Appleton are down. The local average cost is between $3.45 and $3.50 a gallon. Nationally, the average cost is $3.80 per gallon. Wednesday's Powerball jackpot is up to $835 million. Pete Schwabe, WGBW 97.9 News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
Radio keeps your community informed, entertained, and connected. It's what we're all about at the Civic Media Network of local radio stations.
We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin.
This includes a commitment to news.
Now we want to invite you to join Civic Media's exclusive Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News. It's a place to share your community's news and chat with others from across the state about it.
Join the Facebook group, Wisconsin Breaking News, today. It's the perfect companion to your local Civic Media radio station. As Goes Wisconsin with Kristen Brock.
I didn't realize that Tucker Carlson's like hemorrhaging viewers. And I heard yesterday someone was like, oh yeah, like no one's actually watching it anymore. I was like, oh, that doesn't really surprise me. It's kind of like Threads.
it was the same for about five
like a
minutes.
Week. Whoever was excited, then they moved on.
Well, it's like Scott Walker's presidential campaign. It's a big deal for about a week.
As Goes Wisconsin with host Kristen Bry. Weekdays 10 till noon on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. Mino and the Mayor.
Hey, Mike, of all the people that your wife knew in Two Rivers, did any of them have a Shetland pony?
Mike, you're a new listener. John, for some reason,
the only person in the history of Two Rivers that had a Shetland pony when he was a kid.
Star. He was awesome.
Oh yeah.
He was great. I'd come home from school, ride him. He's a great horse. And his Shetland pony, we had him. We didn't. It was great.
Weekday mornings from 6 until 8 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, and on the Civic Media app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow.
Aaron comes in every day looking like he just stepped out of a Turkish bathhouse because it's so hot in there. Just to recap, so far the segment has been filled with dog vomit, old men peeing, and Aaron wearing a dish towel. So we're...
Hey man, your name's on the show. Your name's on the show.
Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Weekday mornings 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. Mino and the Mayor.
What do you think of this team, Brady, with the new quarterback?
It's such a wild card because you go all the way back to Aaron Rodgers. What's been cool about my football experience is I've seen this. Aaron was a good player. Nobody ever expected him to become a first ballot Hall of Famer, especially under the circumstances of having to replace a Hall of Famer, which is rare.
Weekday mornings from 6 until 8 on the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, and Oshkosh Air Support, WISS, and on the Civic Media app.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Who to hate and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So it's been hot labor summer and fall shaping up to bring, well, much of the same kind of stuff as workers have been hitting the streets. President Biden walking a picket line and, you know, walking the walk, talking the talk. You look at the regulatory reforms coming out of the NLRB, attempting to undo decades of bad corporate decisions. I got to tell you, things are starting to head in the right direction, but we need more. We need more. We need comprehensive labor law reform, and we need to return to the original intent of the NLRA, you know, but update it for today's workforce. But I got to tell you, today, a historic day, and that's why I have asked Val Hoyle to come talk with us. Val is a congresswoman out of the 4th Congressional District in Oregon, former Oregon labor commissioner, and someone who is just on the right side of every one of these issues. Val, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you for asking me. I really appreciate it. And I think, as we were saying earlier, when you elect people from labor to positions of power, then you get a voice for working people. But I have to say, in terms of what President Biden has been doing, he is the most pro-union president since Roosevelt, yep. Right? Like, we are seeing, he is leaning in on making sure, whether it's project labor agreements or, you know, appointing pro-worker people to the NLRA, right? And we saw Marty Walsh, who was a former union president, heading up, was Secretary of Labor. I mean, he is walking the walk, although I don't think he gets credit for it because misinformation has gone out there, and the people who are in charge know that if we're fighting each other, then we're not going to be fighting who we should be fighting, which is for workers.
Well, it's the quote attributed to Jay Gould: I can easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. And what's going on right now is they're not even really paying for it because they've built it over the last 40 years of dominating talk radio, of taking over media and inundating working people with divisive messages. And here's your daily outrage candy. They are fabulous at that.
Well, I also think, and, you know, we have to hold the Democratic Party accountable. The Democratic Party, who, you know, it comes down to, when I talk to labor, and again, you know, I'm a third generation union member. My grandfather immigrated here. He was a laborer, joined the newly formed laborers union. My dad was a firefighter, president of the union, and I was a member of the hotel employee and restaurant union. It's Unite Here now. It used to be Here. But I, you know, when you get union members and pro-labor people into office, they make it uncomfortable for you. They're like, well, you're not supposed to say those things. Or I hear Democrats say, well, you know, we used to need unions, but we don't need them anymore. It comes down to wages, hours, working conditions, pensions, and collective bargaining rights. You know, And for union members, that's what we should be voting on. But Democrats are taking labor for granted and have for a while, and labor walked away. So now I think we have a really good opportunity, and workers are sick of it. They see CEOs, pay rising, and they're not keeping up. And so workers are fighting back. But we have to deal with the anti-union right to work laws. We have to deal with, you know, whether it's one of my bills is for FedEx, you know, they should have to organize under the National Labor Relations Act, as opposed to the Railway Labor Act, which means that to organize FedEx, you have to organize every single location, unlike UPS, where you actually have collective bargaining and they got a good contract. So we have a big fight. And again, it means more pro labor and more union members that are in office.
No, absolutely. I'm right there with you. I say it all the time. We need working people in the halls of power if working people issues are ever going to be addressed. But to your point about, you know, the kind of jobs that are out there and them being union jobs, even snobby economists like Paul Krugman, I don't know if you saw his column over the weekend, said that, those manufacturing jobs that we want back, those were only good jobs when they became union jobs. And you could say that about industry after industry. Manufacturing back in the day was grueling, was long hours, low pay, deadly work. And it was unions who brought that back, brought that into family sustaining jobs, good benefits, retirement security, the kind of stuff that we take for granted today.
Well, yeah, my grandmother and her siblings worked in a shoe factory when they were, you know, young teenagers, children, right? We don't do that anymore, but we're seeing it again, right? Because we took our eye off the ball. And, you know, the bottom line is, you know, I had the incredible opportunity to meet Sean Fain, the new president of the UAW. And the reason that we have seen union members vote differently than sort of the same old is they want someone that's going to fight for them. And Sean Fain has just said, look, these new electric car plants, they aren't paying a living wage, right? And yet, like, I own a union made car, I paid more, I saved up because I'm gonna, you know, I look at the UAW website. But the bottom line is, I do that because I want to buy something where someone gets a decent wage and a pension and good working conditions. And what do we got? So I'm really, you know, whether it was the Teamsters with UPS or what's happening with the UAW. And as you know, the president is going out to walk the picket line, but he's putting his money where his mouth is. Now, we also know former President Trump is going to walk that picket line. Josh Hawley, senator from Missouri, is going to walk that picket line. These men have done more to undermine labor, whether it was Supreme Court appointments for anti-union people, anti-worker people, or just outright supporting, you know, right to work laws, or, you know, being union busters. And yet they think they can go onto a picket line and that workers are going to think that they're one of them. And that's just wrong.
No. And the thing is, look, I want Josh Hawley on that picket line. I want him standing there so people can go, hey, what have you done for us here? You know, because I say all the time, Republicans hate working people. Look at what they do. Don't pay attention to what they say. Look at what they've done. And make him defend what his party has done for the last 40, 50, 60 years. Make him defend what he has personally done by putting people on the Supreme Court that made this country a no rights at work country for public sector workers and wanted the filter down into the private sector. Make them defend that. And we don't do enough of that, I don't think.
No, I think you're right. And I got up and spoke on the floor in support of the, you know, the UAW workers and that strike. And I'm proud. And today, Representative Haley Stevens, really great champion for labor in the UAW. I'm an original co-sponsor of the bill called the UAW Job Protection Act, which would ensure that contracts to build or assemble motor vehicles for the federal government stipulate the exact plants where the motor vehicles will be assembled. So we know that we can put into that equation, are the workers getting paid? Is there wage theft? Do they have a pension? Do they have safe, you know, workplaces? And the bottom line is, if we're going to spend taxpayer dollars, then I want to make sure we're spending our taxpayer dollars on the highest quality workforce and the highest quality product.
See, for me, this is an important, it's something I've talked about for years. The idea when we use tax dollars to get whatever we need, you know, whether it's roads or bridges or education or healthcare or manufacturing plants, that the jobs that come out of it aren't race to the bottom, poverty, wage, desperation jobs, but actually high road, family sustaining wage jobs to use our public investments to lift us up as opposed to tearing us down. This is the kind of stuff Democrats should be running on. This is the kind of stuff that they should be pushing at every opportunity.
It's a no-brainer. It's like project labor agreements or having the high standards in apprenticeship that the building trades and the carpenters union, the building and construction trades have leaned in on. You can say, well, you know, union, non-union, you can't dictate what, you know, what we should choose for federal dollars. But if you have a prevailing wage, right, which is the union negotiated wage, then people aren't negotiating on price. So you're not going to be able to take the lowest bidder. But also, I think that we should put other standards. For instance, do they have apprenticeship programs, right? What do they have? Do they have wage theft? Are they a credible employer? What is their safety record? But what I have seen over and over again is there really is a difference between union and non-union, right? Especially in expanding apprenticeship and training the next generation of workers.
No, I mean, and this is a president who's doing this. I mean, the fact that he's walking the picket line, the fact that, you know, I'm guessing he borrowed Obama's comfortable shoes because Obama told me he had comfortable shoes. He was going to be walking those picket lines. I didn't see him in Wisconsin when I was sleeping on the marble floor when the uprising was going on in 2011. I didn't see him on any picket lines. This guy, who the right loves to frame as Sleepy Joe or lazy or whatever it is, there he is out there doing the work. And that's what I love about Jelly Bucket Joe.
Well, that's right. And what we need to do is tell those stories. I have to say, so I was at a city council. Well, I was watching a city council meeting last night in Salem, Oregon, just north of me, where the city council, they determined, and the mayor, that they would appeal. There was a firefighter who had a throat cancer that is common in firefighters. Basically, firefighters have much higher rates of cancer than any other. It is cancer causing.
Right. They're inhaling horrible burning stuff. Yeah.
That's right. Toxic fume. So he died about 4 years ago. And so they said they wouldn't cover it, even though, you know, and I worked on and supported the cancer presumption bill, but they're self-insured. They didn't cover it. The appeals court said they needed to cover it. They waited 2 years until the last day they could appeal it to the Supreme Court. While his wife was in Colorado, seeing his name newly put on the firefighters' memorial in Colorado, and they decided 2 years dragging it out to appeal, putting this widow through that much more. Well, last night, and I watched the testimony, I called the mayor and I told him why this mattered and I hoped he would reconsider. I sent a letter to put on the record that, like, it's not okay, but 350 firefighters showed up and their families showed up where firefighter and you know, family members of firefighters talked about their experience and how offensive it was that people who protect and serve us run into burning buildings, that we would drag them through and not support them when they're, make them beg when they're sick and dying. Well, the city council did overturn that decision last night and we were happy, but it shouldn't have taken that long. And his wife this morning, Tina, she said, I had to watch the hearing again because I've been fighting this fight for so long, watching her husband die of a very bad cancer. And I just didn't believe that it truly happened. But that's the power of a union. That's the power of a union. And we need to make sure that every Democrat is supporting the PRO Act, that we're talking to working people that about supporting them. Again, wages, hours, working conditions, pensions, and collective bargaining rights. I don't care what party you're in. If you're not for that, then you're not for labor.
Yeah, no, this is one of those things I say all the time that, you know, Democrats need to adopt a striker. And I've been saying this for the last 2 years. Get out on these picket lines, walk a day with these people, hear their stories, hear their concerns, and take those back into the halls of power. But to this firefighter story, the sad reality, this is too common. And I asked the question, the same thing with our military. I asked the question, if this is how we treat our heroes, who are going to be the next generation of heroes? Because who are going to be those people who are going to step up in the moment of need, knowing that this is their future?
Well, and that, and that's right. So on 9/11, you will see, you know, every single Republican, every single elected official talk about remembering our heroes. But then when they were out dying, I mean, John Stewart put together an amazing group, but he really, really fought to come to the halls of power and say, in Congress, you put all these 9/11 things up, but yet you will not take care of these women, these men and women as they're dying of cancer. They're dying of cancer because they were exposed to carcinogens. So we won that fight last night. It was a fight that we shouldn't have had to have. And I was proud to stand with the firefighters, but I'll tell you what, I'll send you that video. And we have a firefighter who is a state representative, and her husband, who was also a firefighter, had this same kind of cancer. And she talked about the experience of watching her husband go through that and having to fight to get basic insurance coverage, right? And presumption. So we shouldn't have to fight this fight. And that means getting pro-labor people into office wherever, every single place, from the school board all the way up to the presidency. And I, for one, am incredibly happy with the work that Joe Biden has done to unashamedly support working people.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Congresswoman Val Hoyle. She represents the 4th Congressional District in Oregon. Hoyle.house.gov, the website. Last line of questioning I've got for you. You know, we're still operating in 1930s and horrible 1947 labor law. This is 2023. You know, we need to get things done. Look, I remember the Carter era. They were going to undo a Taft-Hartley. Didn't happen. I remember Clinton was running on, we're going to get strike replacement pushed through. That didn't happen. I shook Obama's hand twice, said we were getting something better than EFCA, got nothing. You've got the PRO Act that we're talking about. You've got the Raise the Wage Act. You've got Paycheck Fairness. We've got all this legislation. We need to get some things moving. What does this come down to?
So here's the deal. The labor laws were designed, put forward, voted on when, you know, my grandmother and her siblings were working in a shoe factory, and it wasn't a safe one. When my grandfather was building bridges without nets, because they just knew that they would lose one man per $1 million spent, and that was an acceptable loss. So we have not updated our labor laws for what work is like now, right? So for the, you know, for people working at home, for people who are independent contractors, right? For the gig economy, we have not moved forward to protect workers. And I do have to say, I personally didn't think Obama did some great things and expanded healthcare, but he was not a pro-union president. So we need to get more people, not just Democrats, although I support Democrats, and without us in power, we will never do anything, any of the things you want to do. But we need to get Democrats who will unabashedly speak up for and stand up for workers. And, you know, workers are standing up for themselves. And I've been on more picket lines than I can count. And I can tell you, there is not a greater feeling, even when you're fighting a hard fight, to know that you're with a group of people that together, you know, you can make a difference. And just look at the contract that the Teamsters got. And I anticipate that the UAW will get too.
Yeah, as well. I've been saying for a while, if we're going to reunite this country, it's under the guise of reunionizing the workplaces and getting people back to earning the wages, hours, conditions that my grandparents fought for. But Val, I appreciate you taking some time for us. Keep up the great work. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much, Congresswoman Val Hoyle. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Hard to believe it's been 46 years since Fonzie jumped the shark. I actually remember that on TV. And look, I loved his quip, Henry Winkler's quip, of he's the only person in Hollywood to jump the shark twice. Because as anyone knows, that has now become the phrase where you've kind of gone off the rails. Or you've literally jumped the shark, but yeah, it's one of those weird moments that I still trying to yeah, I got to tell you, you know, as I was listening to Val Hoyle tell the story about the fireman, it's incredible when you hear these kind of stories of people that we've put up on pedestals, that we've given the title hero to, the people that we look to in times of trouble, and what we do to them when they get into trouble. And I've always asked this question, you know, from the time I was a little kid, you know, when I saw the men coming home from Vietnam being dumped into our housing project with broken minds, broken bodies, horrible drug and alcohol problems, and no help. You know, we were back in Cleveland over the weekend as we were coming back from Michigan, and you know, we drove by the place where I grew up. You know, I had my son with me, and we were in the neighborhood, and I wanted to see what the old neighborhood looked like. And you know, it's one of those things where, you know, memories just come flashing back, and most of them not great. And my son's like, you know, did anything good happen to you? Because, you know, I said, you know, hey, that's where I, you know, the neighbor got into a fight, and, you know, the wife slammed the door on his hand, and he cut his hand, and she kept going back and forth, opening and closing it, and just shredding his arm. And, you know, that's where I, you know, one of the first times I ever saw blood. You know, we went over by another place. I said, you know, I saw someone shot over there. And right next to our house, I said, oh, they took those bushes out of there. I said, you know, there were these giant bushes over there. And that's where we found the guy with the big, heavy army green coat, dead with a needle in his arm. And, you know, and I remember these stories of people who were struggling. And, you know, a lot of them were the people that we put up on a pedestal. Well, not back then. It's the people that we would have put up on a pedestal today. And we didn't help them. And that's why I just have so many problems with what's going on in our society. You know, I saw somebody with one of the, I don't remember the country guy's name who sang the small town song. You know, we take care of our own in a small town, kind of jingoism. And I said, really? You know, really? And the answer is no. We have a government that is broken because of this massive divide between rural and urban, black and white, male and female, gay and straight, whatever division you want to throw in there. They've done a really incredible job of getting us to not focus on what is truly outrageous, which is a firefighter getting cancer from breathing in the toxic fumes from fires over decades and not taking care of them. From, you know, the 9/11 responders who showed up selflessly to look for survivors and ended up getting themselves, you know, whatever diseases came out of that, of burning asbestos and diesel fuel and, you know, all the horrible that was there. And it took years, 16 years to get the bill that was necessary. Because we're still focused on all this dumb stuff. And we've got people in Congress, and I look at my congressman, Scott Perry, as someone who doesn't want to actually get anything done. It's more about his pound of flesh. It's about his ideology more than taking care of people and doing the things that we need to get done as citizens of this country. That's what we should be angry about. That the wealthy get what they want. Corporate America, the billionaires, Donald Trump, they get what they want. He was honest about that. But we, the working people, look what they're doing to these UAMW members. Look at the messaging out of that. Frightening. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 2007. It was that morning that a bridge under construction in Vietnam collapsed. The disaster happened in Kinh Tao, about 100 miles south of Ho Chi Minh City. It was a suspension bridge project to cross the Hao River. The project was run by Japanese firms working with the Vietnamese government. 250 workers were on site at the project when the disaster happened. 55 people were killed and another 100 were injured due to the collapse. One reason cited for the collapse was that torrential downpours had caused the support structure for the bridge to sink. Another possible reason was that the scaffolding on the construction project was too weak to hold the weight. When it failed, it took down a section of the four-lane concrete deck approach ramp with it. The fallen section weighed between 1,500 and 2,000 tons. The collapse was considered the worst disaster in the history of the Vietnamese construction industry. Man Hung, leader of one of the construction teams, described what occurred. Quote, "We suddenly heard a great explosion at a bridgehead. Dust covered a great airspace while workers screamed out. The scene was so terrible. The whole great block fell on people below. Vietnamese, along with Japanese and Filipino rescue volunteers, rushed to attempt to find survivors. 1,000 local residents gave blood at the hospital for those injured. The rescue efforts were hampered by the danger of a further collapse. They had to use a crane to clear the rubble. Finally, after four torturous days, the rescue efforts were called off. The bridge project was completed in 2010. The names of the fallen workers are inscribed on a memorial." Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
When megalomaniac multi-billionaire barons of industry suddenly announce that they are boundless geniuses who must remake society, government, and nature, perk up and pay attention. Their grand schemes of social engineering almost always go badly for us non-billionaires. Having spent their careers in the top-down, self-aggrandizing, exploitative corporate culture, they invariably turn to techno solutions and AI computer models, ignoring such bothersome factors as human dynamics. So look out, for here comes a gaggle of high-tech gabillionaires from Silicon Valley planning to fix America's cities by building an urban utopia from scratch. They've chosen Solano County, northeast of San Francisco, for their startup city, promoting it as a hybrid of technotopia and European urbanity, free from the gritty realities of, you know, real cities. Their plan, however, did not include informing the people currently living there about their scheme. Instead, they dispatched secret armies of lawyers and developers to snap up the area's rich farmland, preparing to surprise the locals by converting their land, community, and culture into the gabillionaires' experiment in new urbanism. One of the moneyed schemers declared that, quote, "The idea is simple. Found new cities, free from old bureaucratic and legal structures, and explore bold new visions of how government should work." But that's not simple. It's simplistic. Also, wholly anti-democratic and un-American. But it's in keeping with the egomaniacal ejaculations of other self-indulgent richies who want to build cities that float on oceans, that orbit in space, or that are built on Mars. This is Jim Hightower saying, let's send all of them there now. Meanwhile, What if more of our billionaires invested their money in funding real solutions to real problems in the real cities America already has?
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So in all the places that we went to, like I said, we were at the Jeep plant in Toledo. We're at a Mopar distribution center in Centerline, Michigan. We showed up at the Ford plant in Wayne, Michigan. And the hundreds of people that we spoke to, a theme kept popping up. The theme of the fact that this is a historic moment. This is what democracy looks like. And the fact that in a democracy, everyone gets to vote. And that voting thing popped up again and again and again. And it reminded me of the kind of energy that we saw back in 97 when the UPS workers went on strike. And that historic strike and the huge victory that they got out of that because of the one man, one vote that came along. The fact that you had kind of direct Athenian democracy. So the fact that this popped up caught my attention, which is why I've asked our good friend Scott Holdison to come talk with us. Scott is on the steering committee. He's the chairperson of the UAWD, Unite All Workers for Democracy. They're kind of the folks that were the impetus, the driving force, however you want to put that. They're the ones behind it. Let's go with that. They're the ones behind it. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Rick.
So, you know, again, as I said, you know, we went to these places and that one thing kept popping up. What do you think?
Well, I think that this is a dream come true, not only for me, but for decades of UAW reform-minded members. You know, direct democracy for electing our international executive board has been a dream of UAW members for decades. You know, now it has finally had an opportunity to take hold, and we want to make sure that we can protect that democracy and make sure that it stays with us for a very long time.
Now, you know, again, your group wasn't specifically named, but, you know, I kept hearing people saying, you know, there are these reformers, there are these people out there who are pushing for this stuff. And while they didn't know specifically who you and Unite All Workers for Democracy was, or is, they knew that there were big changes that happened. So I guess, you know, congrats on that. I'm sure there's a lot more to be done, but this, if nothing else, this was a huge victory.
Oh, absolutely. Like I said, it's been a dream of mine. It's been a dream of generations of reform-minded UAW members. We had an opportunity that others did not have, and that opportunity came about because the administration caucus got too greedy. They had coalesced their power. They thought they were untouchable, and they found out that they weren't. The corruption scandal that erupted in 2017 and really came to a crescendo in 2019 with the indictment of Director of Region 5, Vance Pearson. And you could see from that indictment paper that the current president, Gary Jones, and the former president, Dennis Williams, were deeply involved in that. So a bunch of UAW members got together, you know, just a handful of us to start with. But we started researching our Constitution and trying to figure out ways to fight back against this corruption that infected our union. And democracy was... what we felt was the best way to do that was to put the membership in control of our union once again.
And you know, it's what we believe as trade unionists, or at least I do. It's what we believe in as trade unionists, that we have the ultimate say in the direction that our union goes. And that's a kind of language that was forgotten for a while, I think.
Yeah, well, it wasn't forgotten. It was... you know, there are a lot of people fighting for it, but there were very powerful forces fighting against it. The Ruther administration caucus had kept control of the International Executive Board from 1947 until last year. And they did that through the convention system. They had an ironclad grip on the on the International Executive Board through that convention system, and they did not want to let go of it. One of the reforms we sought was direct elections through a special convention to change the way we elected our international officers, and they fought us tooth and nail on that. And in the end, that effort under our Constitution failed, but the federal government, in their consent decree, required a referendum vote of the membership to decide that question rather than just take it to a convention.
No, and that's great stuff. So let me ask you this, because, you know, I've been watching the news reports of this. You know, Axios today came out with a statement that, you know, Sean Fain's acting more like a politician, you know, rallying constituents than backroom union bosses. And you know, insiders, you know, industry observers, you know, they wonder if he's promised too much. And I'm going, you know, I don't know if it's just, you know, the part of the horse race of the media trying to get people's attention, but it's this kind of, you know, bizarre hot take that sends the rest of society questioning unions overall. So when you read, you hear something like that, what do you think?
Well, I think he's not promising anything. He's taking the members' demands, putting them on the table, and he clearly, you know, framed them as the members' demands. Those were the demands that members all across the UAW submitted through either bargaining resolutions or resolutions to the bargaining convention. And, you know, the members have spoken, and Sean is their mouthpiece. And really, that's all that's happening is he's a reflection of what the membership is looking for in this contract battle.
And what it turns out to is, look, you know, I had had a great opportunity to talk to a lot of members this past weekend. And, you know, people who have been working for, we talked to a guy who worked, you know, 55 years at the plant in Wayne, a guy 50 plus years at the distribution center there in Centerline. I mean, these are people who have spent, you know, longer than most of us have been alive building this company. And the one thing that they said is, you know, this is a moment for us to bring this job back to where it was when I started. This is an opportunity to pass on to my children and grandchildren the same kind of opportunities that I was afforded to work hard, play by the rules, and actually get ahead. And that, again, with the old timers, that theme, it wasn't about them so much. It was about that legacy that I thought was kind of important to bring back.
Yeah. You know, we always wanted to leave this union in a better shape than what we found it. Now, that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to make the next generation, life for the next generation, a little better than we had it. And for the past 40 years, that's not been the case. Our contracts have been going backwards for 40 years. And that kind of marks in time the place where the union, the UAW leadership, decided they were going to work with the companies to protect the companies from foreign investments and other mismanagement of the companies by giving concessions. They always would say that we're going to live to fight another day. Yet our union membership has dwindled over those 40 years. In 1980, our membership was right around 1.5 million members. Now we're a little bit under 400,000 members. So we've lost 1.1 million members in that time frame when we were living to fight another day. So the cooperation scheme that has been the paradigm in the UAW leadership for the past 40 years has not worked. And now we have an opportunity to turn that around. And that's what democracy in our union has done. It's given us an opportunity. Now, what we do with that opportunity remains to be seen. But so far, I like what I'm seeing.
No. And as an outsider looking in, as someone who spent, you know, some time with your members on the line. One, I like what you're doing, because I think for society as a whole, to actually see working people fighting and winning, or at least putting up a good fight, that is societally an enormous thing. But also for the members, the one guy told me that for the first time in the years that he's been there, he's actually proud of what they're doing, and that this is something that he's going to tell his children down the road. I find that we're living those kind of moments that we know are historic.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that peace negotiations have been so open and so available to the membership, and give credit to Sean Fain for being as transparent as, more transparent than any UAW president in my lifetime, and probably the most transparent president ever of the UAW. And, that has sparked the imagination of the membership and put the membership in the driver's seat, really. That open communication is such a paradigm shift from what it used to be. If you look back 4 years ago at the GM strike, workers were on strike for 44 days, and to a member, they knew what they were striking for, but there was an information blackout from the opening of negotiations until a tentative agreement was reached. And when that tentative agreement was reached, it fell short of the membership's demands, but they knew with the leadership, the kind of leadership that we had at that time, that there was no chance of them going back to the table and getting a better deal for us. So after 44 days, they accepted that, begrudgingly accepted that that agreement. But that has sparked an upsurge in the membership of the UAW to demand more. And the direct elections for international officers has opened that door wide open. And Sean Fain stepped through it and is leading the membership to get back what we've lost over these decades. We don't expect to get everything in this contract negotiations, but from what I'm seeing, we're well on our way to making some historic contract gains.
Yeah, especially at Ford. I mean, everybody, when we were in Wayne, everyone was effusive for praise for Fain as what they'd already gotten from Ford. And, the hope was more was coming, and that would be the model of what would trickle across the big three. Do you hold the same kind of optimism?
Well, of course I do. We know that the companies did not want to give what they've given so far. Ford was rewarded by not having their parts depots put on strike because they've moved forward. I would hope that GM and Stellantis executives would see the example that Ford has set and start moving for our members in those parts of the UAW towards what Ford has put on the table. One thing that we haven't seen and that I'm sure is part of the sticking point is pensions and healthcare and retirement for folks that started 2007 or later. And I'm pretty sure those are some of the sticking points. I hope we can get those back in this contract round.
No, in fact, as I was talking, especially to the old timers, they were talking about the amount of concessions they had seen throughout their lives and how much they had given back and how much they had sacrificed to keep these companies afloat. And to be honest, they all seemed, I'm not going to say angry, but they were hurt. They were, I guess angry was a part of it, insulted, however you want to frame that their sacrifices in this moment weren't being recognized by these companies who are pushing back on the idea that these conditions have gotten worse. The wages have gotten worse. All of this job that used to be the gold standard of the working class is now just, a McJob.
Yeah, it really has become that. And, as a legacy skilled trades employee, I've seen my wages stagnate. Since 2007, we've had 2-3% increases in that 14 years. But on top of that, when we suspended COLA, we lost a dollar an hour. It was 99 cents an hour that we gave up. And COLA is a adjustment to your wages. So that was 99 cents an hour forever, right? That was a real hit. And to see the company be so profitable the past 10 years and not even come close to wanting to bring that back. Now, Ford has, after having been put out on strike at the Michigan Assembly Plant, Ford has agreed to bring back that cost of living allowance formula as it was in 2009, according to what President Fain told us last Friday. There have been huge concessions. That's just the tip of the iceberg
right. For
what we've given up to these companies.
No. In fact, everyone said, look, we just want what we were told. Correct me if I'm wrong, but, to the man, they all said, look, we made those concessions to keep these companies afloat because we were told this is the only way they were going to be able to survive, but that they would come back at some period down the road so that, as the sales pitch back then was, we're going to save them now, but eventually when they're on their feet, we're going to get this back. So it's going to be okay. Well, $250 billion over a decade seems like they're on their feet.
Yeah, they've more than made up for what they lost during those dark years for these companies. And, they made a promise to us. At least we felt that there was a promise made to us that these concessions were going to be reversed once they got healthy again. And let me make it clear. It was not our wages that drove these companies into the abysmal position they were in. It was mismanagement. It was a lack of imagination. It was a losing control and losing market share to foreign companies coming in. And that the fact that the UAW has struggled so much to organize those plants has played a role in it. But the role, I think the reason that we haven't been able to organize those plants is that we've been looking like a company union for decades. And we no longer look like a company union. So I think after this contract battle is over, you're going to see a lot of folks flocking to the UAW to join a fighting union, because who wants to join a company union?
There you go.
When you have a fighting union opportunity.
No. I mean, you look at right after the UPS contract was ratified, the number, Indeed.com and all the employment sites, the searching for those jobs went through the roof. And I fully expect that you are correct. As soon as people find out what you get on the other side of this contract, I think you're going to see the same. But Scott, I wish you guys the best. Keep up the great work. I hope you'll come back and talk with us again down the road.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick. And it's always a pleasure to talk with you, brother.
Thanks so much. Scott Holdison, he is the chairman, a chairperson of the UAWD Steering Committee, Unite All Workers for Democracy, UAWD.org. The website, if you want to check out the work that they do, highly suggest it. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1786. Daniel Shays led a group of farmers in an armed uprising. They were angry about taxes levied by the state of Massachusetts. Shays had been a captain in the Continental Army during the American Revolutionary War. After the war, an economic downturn hit farmers hard. During the Revolutionary War, many Massachusetts residents had few assets other than their land. After the war, European businesses refused to extend lines of credit to businesses in Massachusetts. The Europeans insisted on payment of goods in hard cash. Massachusetts businesses, in turn, demanded that their own customers pay with hard cash. Rural farmers could not comply. Farmers began to lose their land when they could not meet their debt and tax obligations. To make matters worse, some soldiers were having a hard time collecting their pay for their military service. When the Massachusetts legislature adjourned without considering the many petitions from those seeking relief from the courts issuing foreclosures, many farmers had had enough. Daniel Shays and others began to organize protests against the harsh economic conditions. Daniel Shays and others ended up in court for non-payment of debts. That led Shays and the other farmers in the armed uprising. The rebels shut down the courts. In turn, the Massachusetts legislature passed harsh measures to try and quell the protests. They issued a resolution which allowed authorities to keep people in jail without a trial. Eventually, militia forces suppressed the 4,000 rebels. Some protesters were pardoned. A few escaped to nearby states, with two being sentenced to death by hanging. Daniel Shays hid in the Vermont woods until he was later pardoned. Even before the Industrial Revolution that gave rise to labor unions, agricultural workers faced many hardships. And this is another example of them banding together to fight for change. Back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So good news, the Writers Guild are no longer on strike. The contract has been accepted. They are going to be moving forward. That is huge news. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to have David Slack on to come tell us what came out of it, what victory looks like. And I got to think the AI part of it going to be a huge component. I'm hoping that they got what they were demanding, because this almost five month long strike, kind of a big deal. And now you've got the UAW on strike, heading into day 13. And what's interesting to me is it's not here that you see the UAW striking the big three, which again, historic. You're seeing around the world auto workers standing in solidarity. You know, in fact, you know, the UAW in the last couple of days have gotten letters from the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, an email from the National Union of Transport Equipment and Allied Industry Workers from Malaysia. You know, all across the world, you're seeing these, you know, from Mexico and South Africa and these places, people saying, hey, when union workers do better, societies, communities do better. And this is important in that if we're going to take on global corporations, because, you know, we talked about this the other day, you know, Jim Cramer, the financial mouthpiece over on, I think it's CNBC, was saying, if I were the big three, I would just move everything to Mexico so that you could abuse Mexican workers. And one of the things that we've talked about over the years is, you know, international solidarity, working with other workers. Because, look, the Chinese workers are not my enemy. Chinese communist government, most certainly. Huge multinational corporations who want to abuse that labor, who want to abuse the lax regulation for labor and environment and all that. Those are our enemies. The race to the bottom is because corporate America is going, hey, more profits because of cheaper labor. More profits for us. More for us. Less for working people. And we've got to be thinking that way again. The fact that, you know, you look at how some of these really bad trade deals, you know, NAFTA was horribly destructive. Would we lose some 300,000 auto worker jobs here in the U.S. because of NAFTA? Real wages have fallen by more than 30% over the last 20 years because of bad trade deals. This is why I think Biden is on the right track. As we're moving towards electric vehicles, as we're, you know, moving an industry, we're saying, look, it's got to be a just transition. The workers can't be the one who always takes it on the chin. And that's part of what this strike is about. Yeah, it's about wages. Yeah, it's about retirement security. Yeah, it's about maybe possibly a shorter work week. It's about reinstating the cost of living, most certainly. It's about ending the two-tier wage system. Yeah, but it's about job security, much like it was in the Writers Guild strike, and much like it is in with the Screen Actors Guild. They are fighting the front line of corporate greed. They're fighting the front line of the tech revolution. It's our unions with a handful of politicians that are putting up the fight. The moneyed interest, they're spending like crazy to keep us against each other. Every working person should find a picket line, should be out there walking with those striking workers, making sure that they succeed, because their success is all of our successes. As their wages rise, so will ours. But we got to do the work. Or they keep doing what they're doing to us. Just making us glad we're not the poor one. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, that's where you get to it. Also, if you missed any portion of the program, make sure you get the podcast. Always there, always.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC.